On behalf of our Board of Governors, as Jackie mentioned, I'm Dan Gibbons, and excited to welcome you all here to City Club today. Thank you. Today's program is somewhat of a new approach to amplifying a topic at City Club, and this came about by conversation with, as so many of you regular City Club folks know, when you come to us with ideas and with relationships and with causes, we try to use this platform to move the ball forward on those folks and organizations doing great things. And in this specific case, Adrienne Talbot, who is a very good good personal friend and also a longtime partner to the City Club of Chicago, came to us with this idea and said, "Hey, we understand you're changing things up a little bit in what you do, and we think that this topic can help, but we think you could also partner up to perhaps raise a few dollars to really move the ball forward." So, in that capacity, we're here today to talk about and hopefully move that ball forward a tiny bit on a topic that impacts certainly everyone in this room, and that is cancer. And unfortunately, it impacts so many people disproportionately that you're going to hear about in a message in a moment. And that's why it's so important to really talk about it and talk about it openly and see what we can do to do our part to help. In that spirit of friendship, Adrienne's good friend and also a good friend of the City Club was going to join us today to make this introduction. Unfortunately, he had to deliver a eulogy for a fallen police officer. So let's keep that officer and their family in our prayers and in our mind today as we talk about so much that's going on in the city, and so much that we here as coming together can do to help. So in that spirit of friendship, I will introduce a video by Adrienne's friend and all of our friend, Mayor Brandon Johnson.
Hello, everyone. I'm Mayor Brandon Johnson. I want to applaud you all at City Club for having these conversations, working to address healthcare disparities in the city of Chicago. While cancer truly affects all of our communities, Black communities face societal, environmental, and economic burdens that lead to a disproportionate burden of cancer cases. Years of systemic disinvestment in Black and Brown communities have led to a severe lack of access to healthcare. These communities face greater obstacles to cancer prevention, detection, treatment, and survival. This results in Black and Latinx communities dying from cancer at significantly higher rates. This disparity demands our attention. I am grateful that you are giving this issue the attention it requires. I want to personally thank Dr. Ige for her leadership in working collaboratively to bring resolve to this long-standing crisis. It will take all of us partnering together and maximizing the impact of each other's work to reverse a history of disinvestment in our communities and truly create equitable health outcomes. Together, we can build healthier, resilient communities across our beloved city. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Johnson. We, as I said, we take our role very seriously here at City Club in utilizing this platform to, you know, enhance and amplify the good that so many are doing. And as I mentioned, this some of the funds raised today because of all you and your donations will be going to Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I believe Catherine is here from the LLS to support life-saving blood cancer research and improve the quality of life for patients and their families. So thank you again for that. And in his personal capacity as a cancer survivor and an advocate, Adrienne's going to be facilitating today's conversation along with Tala Mitchell, another good friend over so many years and a member of the Board of Trustees for LLS, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Tala and Adrienne, thank you for your partnership. Thank you for bringing this to us. This discussion is hugely important. And in joining Adrian and Tawa today, are going to be in the spirit of friendship. Wow. Another good friend of the City Club, UIC Chancellor Marie Lynn Miranda. Chancellor Miranda, and of course, Chicago Public Health Commissioner, who Mayor Johnson referenced in his video, Dr. Simbo Ige, and also the Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Chicago, Dr. Edwin McDonald. So if all of you could please join Adrian and Tawa on the stage, we'll get started. Thank you all for being here, and welcome to the City Club of Chicago.
Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? As Dan said, my name is Adrian Talbot, and I know many of you from my work at the University of Chicago. I'm moderating today's conversation in a different capacity. 1 year ago, I was leaving church with my wife, and I collapsed. She took me to the hospital. I'd had a stroke, and I was diagnosed with a rare form of blood cancer. Over the course of the last year, I've been struck by two things. First is the world-class care that I'm receiving from Michael Drazer at the University of Chicago and from a network of physicians at different institutions around the country. And at the very same time, the degree to which that level of care is not available to my neighbors in the South Shore community. So that's what today's conversation is about. I am going to hand the mic over to Dr. Ige to set the scene for us, if you will, Dr. Ige.
Thank you, Adrian. I am Dr. Simbo Ige, Commissioner for the Chicago Department of Public Health. My job is to safeguard the health of Chicagoans, 3 million, almost 3 million people. And part of that is to make sure that we understand the issues that Chicagoans are wrestling with. So 20 years of doing work in health equity, I realized that it's not sufficient to just talk. It's always better to show your work. So as a true public health person, I am going to be inundating you with data today. So brace yourself. And that is because I believe pictures speak louder than words. So what is the situation of blood cancers in Chicago? We have a number of different manifestations of blood cancer, but the most common that we see, that's more than 4,000 cases a year, is the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And leukemias, myelomas, Hodgkin lymphoma, these are the annual average cases. So every time we look at things in, you know, in aggregate, we're like, well, maybe it's not so bad. So this is not the story, really. The story is that when we start to disaggregate this data and start to look at it by age or sex or race and ethnicity, things start to be a bit more curious. And male, female, there is a slight difference there with males. You know, we're seeing more cases in males versus females, but that is something to take note of for those who are researchers and what's going on there. Now, by age, this is a problem that's predominant among those who are older, especially from age 55 and older. You can see the bars there. They're different colors just to make sure you're paying attention. We're talking about thousands of people who are wrestling with this disease. But once you start getting to age 55, we really need to start paying attention because that's when things start to ramp up. Now, my task was to look at racial disparities. As a black woman, I always pay attention to the things happening to black people. You know, it's just a bias. I own it. But beyond that, there is something that's really striking every time I look at the bars that come before me. The Chicago Department of Health, we look at health outcomes for almost 150 different conditions. That's part of what, you know, your taxpayer dollars can accomplish. But when we look specifically at hematologic cancers, there is something that is striking. We started with how many cases are we seeing? We see cases across board, but can you see there is a blue bar there at the beginning? And for those whose glasses are better than mine, you can see that it is non-Latinx white Chicagoans. So this is interesting. Most diagnoses of hematologic cancer across board happens among white Chicagoans, and followed by black, followed by Latinx. So we are starting with just incidence. How many cases are we seeing? It appears that black, white folks in Chicago are more likely to have hematologic cancers. Now, this is a lot of data. I promise I was going to inundate you, and I'm fulfilling that promise. Now, look. Now, start paying attention. So race and ethnicity is what I'm going to call out, because I told you at the beginning that age is a problem. But this is where things start to look interesting. Number of cases happening. And then we go on to hospital admission. Now, hospital admission is an indicator of severity of disease. Then we go, I will show you after that, number of deaths and then survival. So as the severity of disease gets worse and as death become a reality, there is a flip in the numbers that is very notable. Now, black Chicagoans, you see that number that I highlighted in pink there? 41% of those who are hospitalized for hematologic cancers are black. Now, black folks are not the ones who have the most number of cancers. Somehow, they are the ones that are the most hospitalized. Now, for those who are researchers in here, please make a note. This presentation is not for free. It's for assignment. So I hope you're taking a note. This is your homework. We want to know why. Why is this happening? What is going on here? Now, there is variation by geographic area. There's variation by race and ethnicity. Now, let's go on to mortality. This is one of the things that I really, really pay attention to, because I'm a preventative medicine by training. So I like to prevent the preventable. I don't like to wait until things get worse and then fix it there. I try to fix it. So mortality is a big problem for me. So I was paying attention here. Again, more data. Now, let's look at race and ethnicity too. Not a lot of people are dying. We're seeing 4,000 cases. Mortality around, you know, cancer is around 300, 400 per year. But when you start looking of the 347 people on the average who die from hematologic cancers, how many of them are black? 143 of those who get diagnosed die. And 146 of those people are black. Problem. A big problem for me. So again, and a second assignment. Why? Are you writing that down? Yes, please do. So, survival. Now, this is where things get interesting. I wrote down why in caps in my journal, because this is our job to solve for this. They said, give us the context. This is the context. This is what we're seeing. But it's not enough to just describe things by who, where, place, and say, okay, these things are so. The question that I always want to ask is, are these things preventable? When does a disparity become an inequity? When it is preventable? Just showing these numbers and say there are differences without knowing why they're happening does not help us get to the number. Are these preventable mortality? And the second thing that we need to figure out is, if it is preventable, is it due to factors beyond the control of the individual? If the answer to these two questions is yes, it is preventable and it is beyond the control of the individual, it transforms from being a disparity to an inequity. Now, this is an inequity. Let me tell you why. Regardless of the cancer you look at, survival rate is worse for people of color, period. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, myeloma, AML, HL, ALL, no matter how you slice hematologic cancer, it is the same story. Hispanic, black folks have it worse than other people. So, why? It is not the incidence that is different. Treatment is available. This is the best city to have cancer. I don't wish for anyone to have cancer, but if you must have cancer, then you should be in Chicago. Because then, I mean, we have all these fantastic healthcare systems here. We have more healthcare systems in Chicago than in 15 states. So, research centers, we have the brightest minds here. So why is this happening? Why? Why haven't we figured out why people of color are dying from something that can be prevented and treated at higher rates? So that is the question. So that is my job now, to ask this question and call my colleagues in the room and say, hey, we have fantastic people here doing research. What are you finding? We have fantastic health systems here. What is going on? Why is it that when black folks come into your hospitals, they live in a bag? And why is it that when Latino people come into your hospital, they live in a bag? And when someone is not black or Latino, they walk out of the hospital. What is going on? So assignment. That is the assignment. We have too many resources, too many bright minds, too many options available for this to still be the story in 2024. Yeah. And that is the challenge for us. Thank you. And I know we can do it because we've done it for other things. So this is solvable. This can be prevented. So I know there are other questions that I've been asked to talk about, and I'm going to bundle it. Our job is to make the invisible visible. Our job is to track diseases and show you what is happening. And our job is also to answer the question, are there differences? Yes, there are differences. Are these differences preventable? Yes, they are, because we know some other people walk out of those hospitals. Are these differences due to circumstances beyond the control of the individual? We know that it is, because some individuals go in and come out, and some individuals go in and do not come out. So there are inequities in cancer outcomes in the city of Chicago. That is a problem. So that is my job, to let you know there is a problem. Now, the second part of my job is to work with you all to find solutions. And how do we know that we're making progress when we start seeing a convergence? Before 1970, when there was no mammogram, when there was no treatment for breast cancer, everybody was, you know, carrying the same burden. As treatment emerged, we started seeing things diverging. And this is the summary here. This pattern that we're seeing with hematologic cancer is similar to all the patterns that we have seen, that inequities increase as treatment and preventive measures become available. So the problem, the why, is in the inequities in our practices, in our systems, in what we pay attention to, and what we celebrate as progress. Can we begin to celebrate convergence? Can we begin to celebrate equity as the measure of progress? So I look forward to the conversation with my co-panelists for the rest of today. And I leave here very resolute and convinced and hopeful that in this room, there are answers. And in this city, there are answers. So let's find them together, because I know together we can. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Dr. Uguay. I think you've helped us understand the nature of the problem. One of the things I want to talk with the group about is how we work together across sectors. Chancellor Miranda, let me start with you and ask about UIC. What is UIC doing to address these disparities presently? And what are your plans for the future for how the university can get even more in the game?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say, Dr. Ige, we have taken up your assignment in a big way, even before you assigned it to us. So, yeah. So at UIC, if you look at the work that we're doing around cancer, it is completely and entirely focused on cancer health disparities. UIC's mission is to provide the broadest access to the highest levels of educational research and clinical excellence, and that mission is very much embedded in the approach that we take to cancer research, cancer care, cancer education. So we have focused on a set of cancer endpoints that are characterized by deep disparities, so cancer, lung, liver, colorectal, breast, and prostate, characterized by very compelling disparities absolutely need to be addressed. So focused on those five cancers, and we're also focused on specific geographies that the data tell us. I'm a big fan of data also, that the data tell us in these geographies we need to go in and do some preventive intervention, make sure we're doing more screening, those sorts of things. In identifying the cancers that we're going to focus on and in identifying the specific geographies we focus on, we've done that in partnership with the community. So the idea that to do this well, to really shift from the inequity that exists right now to whole structural approaches that really empower and enable communities to take care of themselves, you have to be in the community talking to them, having them take part in the decision making in our cancer center. So I'm going to give two examples. One, we in identifying these specific geographies, we identified that as you know, the stage of diagnosis for breast cancer is much worse for women of color than it is for others. Even though women of color are less likely to get diagnosed with breast cancer, they're more likely to be diagnosed at a later stage. When we looked at the data, you know, lots of people were thinking maybe this is genetic. When we looked at the data, what became clear is that the screening rates were very differential. So we implemented a program. We picked a geography. We implemented a program to do outreach through all kinds of community-based organizations to increase screening rates for breast cancer. And we stuck with it. It was a sustained effort. And through that effort, there was a 20% decrease in the stage at diagnosis of breast cancer patients among women of color.
Very true.
So another example I'll give is we have this great researcher named VK Gotti. There is a standard 21 marker panel that when someone is diagnosed with breast cancer, I'm giving two examples from breast cancer. When someone's diagnosed with breast cancer, you do this 21 marker panel, and based on what you learn from that 21 marker panel, you make a decision about what chemotherapeutic regime or radiological regime you're going to put people on, right? What our researcher discovered is that this 21 marker panel, which had been tested on these databases that are out there, those databases underrepresent women of color. They in particular underrepresent Black women. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that that 21 marker panel tended to not give the best option for Black women in our clinics. Mm-hmm. So we immediately changed the practice in our clinics. We are in the process of one of the other researchers on this, Kent Hoskins, presented at the American Cancer ACSO. Acronym, right? So presented this as a plenary presentation, trying to get the word out to other places. And it's not just that we want people to pay attention to the accuracy of that marker. We're trying to develop that test. We're trying to develop what's the alternative that works well for the Black women we see in our clinics and the Black women that are seen in clinics all over the country. Right. So for us, working on cancer health disparities is the first, middle, and last thing we do when we're attacking this disease that is so very difficult on individuals, on families, and on entire communities.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, you asked me the question, but I felt compelled to.
Thank you.
You're making the right decision, for sure. Thank you for helping us understand what a leading university can do in this space. I want to talk about the nonprofit sector. You, aside from hanging out with me and riding bikes, and aside from helping lead the MacArthur Foundation, are on the board of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. What does the organization do, and how can the nonprofit sector and institutions like it help address these disparities?
Thanks, Adrian. First of all, thank all of you for being here today and for your attention to this topic, which is such a near and dear issue to my heart, because my husband is a chronic lymphocytic leukemia survivor. My mother is actively battling multiple myeloma and amyloidosis, which is a rare blood disorder. And when my husband was first diagnosed in 2011, the first thing you want to do is find out information. What is this? How? What are the prevalence rates? What are their survival rates? How can you fix this? How can you fight this? And we were first referred to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and that is because it is the premier organization that helps families and caregivers and patients get educated about what these diseases are, not just leukemia, not just myeloma, but all sorts of blood cancers and blood disorders like amyloidosis and others that you also have never heard of. And so that education piece is so important. What am I dealing with and how can I address it? The second thing that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does is actually advocate on behalf of these patients. I have personally gone with the organization to Washington, D.C., to other places, seats of power at the city, state, county, and federal levels to advocate for parity around the drugs that address this issue. And any nonprofit can do this, and many do. But I, of course, as a trustee of the LLS, talk about what it is that we do well. For example, many of Black and Brown patients that get diagnosed with these diseases are often not able to treat themselves with the latest and greatest targeted therapies that would most affect and help advance their health care and help treat the disease. And that is because, in many instances, insurance companies don't cover them the same way. So there is not parity between intravenous chemotherapy and other forms of targeted therapies that you can take a pill for. And that is really unfortunate. If a pill costs $400 uphill to take to treat your cancer, and we know it's effective, but you can't afford it, what good is that medication? So LLS and other organizations in the nonprofit sector help advocate to ensure that our lawmakers, that our other healthcare professionals and insurers understand why health parity in this regard are so important. And lastly, treatment, right? Like, we have to research to get the best treatment opportunities and options out there. Cancers change and morph and evolve, and so the treatments to cure those diseases do as well, and that costs money. So organizations like LLS and others help to advance that research. So thank you for the question.
Thank you. Dr. Ige, thank you for helping us understand the nature of the problem. Chancellor Miranda, you've helped us understand what a leading research university can do. And Tawa, you've helped us understand where the nonprofit sector can step in and make an impact. None of that works unless we can reach communities, and communities of color in particular. So Dr. McDonald, I want to ask you, as you lead this work at the University of Chicago, what are the main challenges you run into, and how are you trying to overcome them?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So there are a lot of challenges, but before I get into the challenges, I want to tell a story just to give more context. So for me, I'm a native Chicagoan, and my interest in cancer and interest in healthcare really started at a young age just by going to church. Okay, now what does church have to do with cancer? why is there a connection? I remember being a young kid, and every Sunday the pastor would say, you know, sister such and such is sick and shut in with cancer. Or brother such and such is sick and shut in with cancer. At the age of 10, I knew more about cancer than I did Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And it's like, we laugh, but there's some serious in that, seriousness in that, in the sense that one of the reasons why I became a gastroenterologist, like, I was exposed to people who had colon cancer at an early age. And it bothered me as a kid and still bothers me as a gastroenterologist to this day. So it's one of the reasons why I really try to focus on community outreach. And a lot of the community outreach that I do focuses on the social determinants of health, okay? So you clearly show that there are some disparities in terms of the diagnosis of cancer, and you pose the question, why?
Right.
So these social determinants are part of the answer, but you can't just, it's not enough to say, oh, they're social determinants, that's why people have cancer, different race. We really have to truly understand what these social determinants are and also what the solutions are. So at the University of Chicago, one of the things that we do, not only University of Chicago, but all nonprofit hospitals, we do our community health needs assessment. Mm-hmm. And we are mandated to do a community health needs assessment every 3 years. And within that community health needs assessment, we have to not only get data in terms of rates of cancers within our service area, incidence and mortality, but we also have to understand truly what people are dealing with in those service areas, in that service area. So at the University of Chicago, 17% of our population suffer from food insecurity and low food access. And we know clearly that diet can play a role when it comes to increasing the risk of cancer. And it's a role that I am very well aware of. It's one of the reasons why I actually became a chef. So throughout my medical training, I saw a lot of people who were dealing with dietary issues. As a matter of fact, I worked at a clinic on the South Side called Project Brotherhood, and we had focus groups specifically dealing with social determinants of colon cancer. And I, as a medical student, led a lot of those focus groups. And one participant stuck out in mind to this day. He basically said he was just eating hot dogs every single day. Mm-hmm. And then we were having conversations about what cancer is and what role diet plays. Like, he didn't really have an idea that eating hot dogs every single day is probably not the best strategy for preventing cancer. And not only that, when it came to cancer prevention, he really didn't know what cancer was. So when we asked him, like, what is cancer? Can you define cancer? And I not only posed that question to him, but probably 20 other men in the group. And everybody said a variety of different things, but all of them were far from what cancer actually is. So one person in particular said cancer is a fungus that grows on you, or cancer is when the doctors don't know what's going on, they just say you have cancer.
Very true.
And that's really an indictment of the healthcare system.
Right.
I don't think this is an indictment of their educational level. It is an indictment of our failure to educate. So these are all educated men who are capable of understanding exactly what cancer is. But the problem is the conversation was not happening. And it wasn't happening in the hospital, nor was it happening in our educational system. So a lot of times people became at risk. People were living a life that was putting them at risk for a disease, and they had no idea. And for me, that is very frustrating and very upsetting. And it's one of the reasons why we do a lot of outreach when it comes to interacting with the community, understand what their needs are and what their priorities are, but also working with them as a group, as a team, as you mentioned, to provide some of the education to help people really decrease some of these risk factors for cancer.
Yeah. That's great.
That's great.
Dr. Uge, I want to come back to you and then open up to the others. I want to ask about collaboration. I think we all work in worlds that are effective but often siloed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask for your thoughts on first how the city is getting involved in addressing the social determinants of health that Dr. McDonald mentioned, mm-hmm. and how can the city do a better job of promoting collaboration?
Yes, I will give the example of COVID when we were facing a collective threat, and how that facilitated collaboration and synergy in a way that's unprecedented. You see the best of Americans when there is an emergency. But what happens when we're outside of an emergency? So blue sky scenarios, people go back into their little spaces, and we lose that ability for collective impact. And that's one of the areas we're trying to do better. And it's like not just when we have an infectious disease, there are some shared threats that we have in our city. And how can we collectively use the little resources we have here and there collectively in a way that can lead to synergistic, multiplied impact? So that's one of the areas that we are exploring and wanting to do better, especially around chronic illnesses. Public health is traditionally funded for infectious diseases, and we don't have the same support for chronic illnesses, especially illnesses that have a lifestyle component, because people feel like it's your responsibility. So a part of this is saying beyond the individual responsibility, what are the systemic structural things that we can address? part of that is what, you know, has been highlighted in terms of the what insurance covers or even having insurance at all, and the need for pre-authorization and all of those structural limitations that prevent people from getting access to the care that they need. That is a policy issue. That is conversation that needs to happen at all tiers of government. So the advocacy that is happening, we complement that with subject matter hearings and providing data on why it is cost-saving to have early prompt diagnosis and treatment with the best kind of treatment instead of this stepwise, you know, people trying other less effective measures before they are eligible for better measures. The third part that we feel like we can do a better job of is the intersectoral collaboration. We talked about social determinants. When people don't have food, they cannot be healthy. When people don't have transportation, they're not going to go to their appointment. Mm-hmm. When people don't have childcare, they're not going to miss, you know, they're going to miss their appointment. When people don't have paid time off or sick leave, they're not going to take time off to go get their care. So this requires collaboration with sister departments, our Department of Family Support, our Department of Transportation. Everything is health these days because housing is health, food is health. And if we narrowly define health as just treatment and healthcare and medication, then we're missing 80% of the things that determine health. So we are challenged by how broad we need to network and how much collaboration is really necessary to change health outcomes. And I think that's the area where we need to do better. A better engagement with our healthcare system, better engagement around in government, around policy, and also better engagement around other sectors, educational, all of those. So let people see that health is important in everything that we do so that we can be a bit more strategic in where we put our resources.
Great, thanks. That's an important point. I want to ask you this idea that not just hospitals are responsible for healthcare. Mm-hmm. Dr. McDonald, you work a lot with nonprofit organizations. Talk to us about collaboration between sectors.
Yeah, so I'm on the board of multiple different organizations here, but I do a lot of community outreach when it comes to nutrition education. So again, I became a chef, and once upon a time, I started doing cooking classes in the hospital. Mm. Okay, now you could only reach so many people in the hospital if you're doing cooking classes, and the people that were reaching were already coming to the hospital, so it was an audience that was already engaged in healthcare. And I posed the question, how do I reach people outside of the hospital? How do I reach people who need to be connected to the hospital but they're not connected for a variety of different reasons? Lack of access, mistrust, education, etc., all the social determinants that we mentioned. So I partnered with nonprofits and just started doing classes in churches, doing classes for community organizations. I was a one-person show. And thankfully, I ended up getting some grant funding, and now I don't have to do all the classes myself because you can only reach so many people as an individual. So now I have multiple different chefs doing classes throughout multiple different neighborhoods. And we specifically targeted neighborhoods that have the lowest life expectancy in Chicago. And I think this social determinants question is very important for everybody in this room because in the city of Chicago, despite having excellent health care, despite having excellent facilities, we have the largest gaps in life expectancy of any city in the United States.
Very true.
And to me, although I love the city, this is a city that I'm very proud of, but that's shameful. And it's shameful because I think we can do better. I think we really can. And with community organizations, I think in order to do better, it's going to take partnerships, not only from the hospital, because the hospital does not have all the answers. We do have some answers. We have some resources. But it takes partnerships with government and our civic leaders, and then also nonprofits and community organizations. Because ultimately, when you're trying to reach the community, everybody has to play a role. And we are all part of the community that we're trying to reach. And once we start recognizing that as Chicago, we are all interconnected, I think that'll put us in a better position to solve some of these disparities.
Hey. You want to add something?
Yeah, I you know, yes to everything that's been said. I just want to throw one additional thing in there. So I agree with you completely about, you know, the link between health and education, mm-hmm. health and nutrition, et cetera. It's one of the reasons that I was so attracted to come to UIC however many years ago, last year.
One. The answer is one.
It seems like a really good lifetime. Still maintain I have the best job in Chicago. Uh-huh. But, you know, we have a School of Social Work. We have a College of Dentistry. We have a College of Nursing. Mm-hmm. We have a College of Education. We have a College of Engineering. So, and we have alums all over the state and all over the country. So, who run nonprofit organizations, are involved in the government sector, etc. So we try to leverage all of those different connections. The one thing I want to make sure that we're really, we're really tapping into all the resources that are at our disposal to make a difference in these issues. And the one thing I want to add to social drivers of health is sometimes people don't realize the extent to which environmental exposures are linked to where you live. And so I've worked on environmental justice my entire professional career. And a great example of collaboration is this Cache Center, which is joint between the University of Chicago and the University of Illinois Chicago, where it's focused on environmental justice outcomes with a particular emphasis on cancers. And we're not interested in competing against the University of Chicago. We're interested in, you know, holding out our hands together and saying, what can we do together for the city of Chicago? We can be stronger when we choose to work collaboratively instead of thinking that this is a competitive space, because the thing that we should be competing against is cancer.
Right. Uh-huh.
All right. Well, we're a little short on time. I, as my doctor knows, tend to show up to appointments with lots of questions, but more than we have time for. So I want to talk to you in a personal capacity. Take off your hat as chancellor. Take off your hat as a member of LLS. And to the degree that you all want to step in, tell us about your own personal journeys, your interactions with cancer, and most importantly, how do you take care of yourselves and how do you take care of your family?
Mm-hmm. I can start. My own personal journey, as I said, was through my now husband, who was initially diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia over a decade ago now, and his survival is solely dependent on his excellent care that is provided by Dr. Vinu Gobel at Rush University Medical Center. Similarly, my mother turned 80 on February 2nd. Shout out to her. Shout out to both of them for being here. And so to get this diagnosis at this age of multiple myeloma and this rare blood disorder of amyloidosis, and shout out to Dr. Benjamin Derman in the Hem-Onc department at University of Chicago, who is also outstanding, those institutions, along with the care connections and support that we are receiving through the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, are why they are able to join us at this lunch today. But this is personal for me because that's not the story for far too many people, as you've heard through Dr. Ige's slides. And why is that? I believe it's hard for me to disentangle my personal and professional lives. I, in my day job, am a philanthropist at the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And it's our job to literally help to seed these connections that you've heard about here today. One of the things I'm most proud of is a $1 million fund that we are partnering with the City of Chicago to help shore up the nonprofit sector in Chicago so that they are ready when the time comes. So when the next COVID-19 happens, that we can easily and quickly deploy resources to community-based organizations so that they can organize their neighbors, they can organize their partners. And I realize that I probably shouldn't have said that out loud because I don't think we have formally announced this partnership yet. But it is the role of philanthropy to exceed and innovate the kinds of things that we're talking about today.
Okay, everybody.
And so it is personal for me because I am from South Shore. I am a Black woman. I am from the South Side. I do have family members who are affected by so many cancers, not just Black cancers. I never got to meet my mother-in-law because she succumbed to Black cancer in 2008. And so it's personal. It's personal to me that all of you are here, that you paid your money to be a part of this conversation. And we need to bring our friends here and figure out what they can do so that we can ensure that these disparities stop with us today.
Hi. It's hard to follow that. I don't have a program to announce. And the way that you talk about this with your family is really inspiring and moving.
Thank you, Chancellor.
It's interesting, as I was listening to you talk, I found myself getting emotional because, you know, I felt like I understood at some level some of the things that you and your family are going through. So I have three children. My youngest child, when she was really little, she would always come home. She would always talk about how she wanted to be a cephalopod scientist. Mm. And what is a cephalopod? Octopus, squid, cuttlefish, all that. She wanted to be a cephalopod scientist. One day when she was about 10 years old, she came home and she said, "I've changed my mind. I don't want to be a cephalopod scientist anymore." And we said, "Well, all right, what do you want to be?" And she said, "I want to be a pediatric oncologist." So, you know, you got a 10-year-old, and usually a 10-year-old says something as serious as, "You want to be a pediatric oncologist," you smile. But with this kid, you're like, "Yeah, I can see you. I definitely see you as a pediatric oncologist." And about then she's in high school, and she was really sick in high school, really, really sick. And we saw a lot of specialists, tried to figure out what was going on. She was so sick for like 3 years, and it was 3 years before we got a diagnosis that she had a lymphatic cancer. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever done anything as hard as walking alongside my child when they were battling cancer. If there was anything I could have done to like take the treatment myself, to go to all those doctor's appointments, I would have done it in a heartbeat, but all you can do is walk alongside them. Yeah. And you have to think about the fact, I have two other children, right? And they're devastated by this diagnosis. They're worried about their sister. You have to make sure that you're connecting with them and make sure that they're okay. And then, you know, I'm married. I've now been married for 34 years. But you better pay attention to the fact that that's the kind of stress mm-hmm. that can tear couples apart. And we very deliberately made this, we got to make sure that we get through this together and we as a couple come out the other side stronger as we celebrate what we hope will be our daughter's return to good health. So, I had to make some significant decisions about my professional life. At the time, I was a provost at another university. We made the decision to have our daughter treated at Michigan Medicine because of the particular cancer and chemotherapeutic regime that we chose. So I stepped down from this leadership position. It was an easy decision to make, but the impact that it can have on a family where you have to make those mm-hmm. kinds of decisions. The happy story here is that last year she hit 5 years cancer-free. Yeah. Year, she's a first-year medical student.
Yes. No.
On her way to becoming a pediatric oncologist. So, and I just say, you know, people have a hard time figuring out what do you say to people when these things are going on. Mm-hmm. So, whatever you do, don't say, "I did some research," right? Because the likelihood that you've read more about this than the family is unlikely. Do say things like, can you put all your laundry out on your front porch on Monday morning? I'm going to come by, and when you get back from the hospital, all that laundry is going to be washed and folded and cleaned. Do say things like, don't do things like make us take care of you, like start crying so that we have to take care of you mm-hmm. instead of you, you taking care of the family. Do things like, so when you go to the hospital, you're there all day. Can I get a key? Can I get into your house and clean your house for you while you're gone? And I will use unscented cleaners so none of the smells set the nausea off or anything like that. There are all these concrete things you can do to help families, and that is just so, so meaningful that, like, when you come home and you feel that the presence of people having taken care of you.
Mm-hmm. There.
I love that you mentioned what people can do to support folks and families who are going through cancer. It reminds me of a patient. She was young, unfortunately got diagnosed with cancer at an early age, and she had a malignant bowel obstruction from cervical cancer. And I had her on IV nutrition, and for IV nutrition, you have to have a refrigerator in your house to actually store the IV nutrition bags. So she lived in a multi-generational house where there was no room in the refrigerator. And the home care company, they wouldn't pay for a refrigerator. Insurance companies wouldn't pay for a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't let her leave the hospital unless she had a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. I went to Best Buy and got her a refrigerator. And thankfully, I have the resources to do that for one patient, but I can't do that for every patient.
Nice.
But that is a patient who lived in Englewood who needed support, family support, or social support. And we do have to figure out a way as a society, how do we support people who are going through things? I love that you asked us, what our connections are with cancer, but also what are we doing for stress? In terms of my personal connection with cancer, I took my father to get his colonoscopy when he was 50, and I was around the age of 16, 17, 18 or so. And the gastroenterologist took off a large polyp. So while my dad was recovering, I'm sitting there waiting for the gastroenterologist. And the gastroenterologist comes, talks to me, because my dad is still somewhat sedated. And the gastroenterologist says, yeah, it was a big polyp. I took it off. Just let him know. I'll get back in touch with him. I'm going to Ponderosa to get some wings now. And I'm like, wait, you just took off something called a polyp, and now you're going to get wings? So my dad wakes up. And I tell him he took off something called a polyp, and he is at the buffet getting wings now. About a week later, we found out that the polyp had a little bit of cancer inside of it. However, the gastroenterologist took all of it out, so my father didn't have to have surgery or any further treatment. He just had to have more frequent colonoscopies. And I remember hearing that. I'm like, wait, this dude just saved your life and got wings? That's insane.
What kind of wings?
Yeah. Must have been really good.
No, I'm just saying angels went.
Exactly, yes. But it was part of my inspiration to become a gastroenterologist.
That's cool.
I do want to talk about stress management. So stress in of itself is a risk factor for cancer.
Right.
So stress can cause epigenetic changes, so changes to our DNA that can put us at risk for cancer. So it's really important that we do focus on managing stress and also be aware of stress in our environment. And that's one of the reasons why at the University of Chicago, so we are building our new cancer center. And in the cancer center, the second floor is going to be dedicated to things that help people manage stress. So they're going to have a teaching kitchen, which I'm helping supervise. But there's also rooms for yoga, rooms for meditation, and rooms for a variety of stress-reducing initiatives.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. I think we're out of time. Let me just say that none of us plan to get cancer.
Mm.
It's not the plan for any of our lives. But we live in the greatest city in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we can work together to make sure that the top level care that we've heard about today is available to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to look to the person to your left and say what I say to my wife every morning, which is, we got this.
We got this.
We got this.
We got this.
We
We got this.
All right. Thank you all for coming today.
Thank you. We got this. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. As they take a final photo, thank you very much to our panelists. This was a question that was actually more of a statement from Javette. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for the presentation and for sharing. And by the way, we will share this presentation on our website under the events videos. That'll be available. Please share that widely. But a special thank you and acknowledgement, of course, to all our survivors and their families. As Dr. Ige said, if you're going to have cancer, have it in Chicago. Just as if you're going to, they're great hospitals, they're great healthcare. If you're going to want to get an education, you're going to want to do it in Chicago. You know, we've got UIC, U of C, we've got Loyola, Northwestern, incredible places. With such a difficult topic, remember all the positive that's happening. If you want funding, look at all the great foundations we have to help implement some of these things that you're learning, like through MacArthur, through the Joyce and Chicago Community Trust, family foundations like Malnati. That all leads to investment that really brings the best workforce to Chicago, companies like Peoples and Stiefel. And this is an ecosystem. As Adrian said, this is where all of us coming together in this room, we like to believe here at City Club, that by doing this, coming together, listening to each other, talking about the good that others are doing, that we are making things just a little bit better by collaborating, by not competing, like the Chancellor said, and by doing the right thing and amplifying all the good messages. So I just wanted to say that to remind everyone, it's important that you're here in this room. It's important that you're supporting these organizations and all these people doing great work. And there's so much more to come at City Club. So thank you to our panelists. Thank you, Dr. Ige, for setting that up. Thank you, Dr. McDonald, for all that you're doing, Chancellor Miranda, and also sharing those personal stories, how important this has touched every one of us, as it has Tawa and your family, and, of course, Adrian. Thank you for bringing this to City Club. Thank you all. Thank you to the Chicago Sunday Evening Club again. You guys are great. And we'll see you all back here soon at City Club. We also have our amplification on November 14th, which is a great, fun celebration of all these great things that we're doing. So we hope to see you soon at a program or, of course, at our celebration amplification. And I hope that you all have a great rest of your week and keep all those good things in mind that are happening while we remember those that we've also lost. Thank you. Welcome back to City Club anytime. Have a great day.